I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box. In the information age, are there dark forces amassing against us? Have we slipped past a line of control in our online lifestyles? Well, I spoke to Rachel Bainton and Gillian Lees about these themes as they see them, through their performance theatre piece, A Machine They're Secretly Building, which played recently at Mac Birmingham.
I'm with Rachel and Gillian in a very echoey, sterile room, somewhere in the back of the Mac, with lovely custard, kind of mustard colour, really, walls, but we won't dwell on that too much. I'm really excited to have this interview because I think it's a very intriguing production that you're putting on.
Thank you.
And I think there's a kind of a nexus, if you like, if I can use that word. It's a very highbrow word. I'll try to use that. In terms of technology and security and culture, and I think that's what you're trying to tap into. And the show, the performance, is called A Machine They're Secretly Building.
Yes.
Now, what I glean from what I've seen so far, that's kind of taken from Edward Snowden. So,
absolutely, yeah. It was, we started making the show being interested in sort of looking at these hidden powers that governments have, or the full-take surveillance that was kind of going on that we might perhaps weren't aware of. And we're obviously interested in the revelations that Edward Snowden provided that all appeared in The Guardian. We were looking a bit at WikiLeaks, at whistleblowers like Chelsea Manning. And yeah, that quote from Snowden just seemed really apt that they were, he says that he can't in all conscience keep quiet about this machine they're secretly building, this surveillance machine. And it just seemed to flow from there.
And there's a question, I think, Joan, you might be able to help me with this one. There's a question in the title about who they are.
Yeah, I think that's a really salient point, actually, because part of the premise for Rachel West and I to start making this piece was trying to ascertain who they are, that there's a sense amongst ourselves, our peers, our family and friends, that when they're referring to people that make the decisions, the large decisions that govern our lives, that they wouldn't do this to us. They couldn't allow this to happen to us. And when we questioned one another on who we believed they were, none of us could articulate it. And that seemed incredibly problematic and a really useful place actually for us to start investigating who they are. Yeah.
Talked a lot about us and them. And I think there's even a line in the show where it's like, you know, when did it become about us and them? It's your line, isn't it? And they are us.
Yes, they're supposed to be us, but it's quite it transpires that it's quite obvious there's two teams, and who are they?
So it's tapping into, I guess, some questions around not just ownership, but I guess community in a sense, in terms of how we, you know, what are our assumptions based on? How do we define safety and security and identity is another word, isn't it, that kind of that crops up. Now in the show itself, you both play, I don't think you play characters, you kind of play platforms, don't you? You kind of, you kind of channel things or attitudes or...
We kind of borrow, we sort of think of it maybe as putting a hat on for a moment and taking it off, or jumping into a world or a situation for a moment and pulling back out again, but ultimately we're kind of ourselves.
Being
or
heightened versions
heightened,
of ourselves.
Version of ourselves. And we talk about, you know, where we are, could be a newsroom, could be a bunker, could be a hideout, it might just be a theatre.
Yeah.
It could be any of these things and all of those things.
And similarly, we could be secret agents, we could be double agents, we could be rebels, or we could just be really frightened like you.
There's a bit of a question, I guess, about, you know, who's on trial. Is it you two on trial? Is it the audience on trial? Is it the media on trial? Is it, you know?
Yeah, and I think that in the show, certainly, there's a purposeful ambiguity about that. Whether or not we are questioning the audience or supporting the audience, whether we're questioning ourselves and one another, or the government, or whomever, there's always this sort of concern of ambiguity.
There was an audience member that saw the piece and described it as a eulogy from the end of history, which we thought was quite nice, that this kind of looking back on perhaps where we'd gone wrong or where we could go wrong, that the show was acting at points in that kind of way. And I think we found when we started making the piece, some of this stuff felt very almost conspiracy theory. People, you tell people what we were looking at, and they're going, yeah, but that's not exactly true, is it? But as we've gone on, it's this show started to feel less like a prediction and maybe almost starting to be a bit of an I told you so. Things are coming true, and as we've toured it over the past year or so, it's become these things that we were dire predictions are starting to look more like actual fact.
Yeah.
So it's drawn, I think, from a range of sources. So you've got things that are clearly from intelligence documents, things that are film, news media, music, archive things, Pathé showreels, all those kind of different things. And what strikes me about that content is these are things now that are quite readily available, kind of through some of the things that you're attacking, or not, maybe not attacking, but kind of flagging that are potentially quite dangerous.
I think we've been... One of the points of the show is that, you know, that idea of should you change your behaviour? Should you alter how you behave in light of the fact that, you know, yes, I mean, we're promoting this show through Facebook. We're promoting this show on the radio, through Twitter, you know. We're using all of those channels. I think perhaps what some of our research has led us to is not the idea that we should change, but that we enter into these contracts with our eyes wide open, that we're informed. So I know when I give Facebook that photo or that message that I've given it to them. It's theirs.
Not necessarily do I own it any longer. And I think something that's quite interesting as a side note that we've recognised that has been quite a shock to a number of our audience members is that general consensus might have us believe that when we put something on Facebook to tell Mark Zuckerberg that you don't have the right to that image or that statement. There's a general consensus that if we all believe in that, if we all, you know, then that must be the case. But it absolutely isn't. So there's so many untruths that we convince ourselves and one another of that nobody really has a sense of, in terms of legal requirements, what the case is. So yeah, it's about questioning yourself as well as to what you're prepared to believe.
So how do you approach, I'm fascinated about how you approach pulling it together. So there's lots of kind of, you know, there's lots of sources, there's lots of, I'm guessing that, you know, there's a building tension, if you like, a kind of creative tension in terms of, you know, there's something here that I want to kind of hone and pull into a kind of, you know, focus. How do you approach that? It's really difficult in terms of the variety and the diversity of the things that you're trying to explore, I think.
So, as prototype, we're a three. There are three of us, and so there's me and Gillian and Andrew Westerside, who's the writer and director of the piece. And so, between the three of us, we were playing with material, sifting it, working out, you know, Gillian and I would be trying to get our heads around things and work out what the hell was going on and what we knew and what we didn't know and what we needed to know. And at the same time, Wes, as a writer, sat there shaping these conversations, these moments, this research. So some of the kind of the shaping and the gathering and the collating of all of this and the sifting out what's actually useful, it took time.
Yeah.
It took kind of a year of working in different places and not working the whole year, but meeting up at different points with time in between to go away and catch your breath and work out, what's the important bits. So, yes, some of it's just time and playing with the material and kind of keeping talking between the three of us.
I guess it's difficult, certainly with some of the kind of historical markers that you use, not to overuse them. And what I mean by that is you've got to use them to sketch context.
Yes.
But what you're trying to get to is about relationships, not always human relationships, but human technological relationships, I guess. That's no mean feat, is it, really?
The show's kind of in two halves, almost, really. In the first half, sort of takes us on this historical journey through those milestones, those historical moments, and kind of tries to bring us through this history of surveillance up to a kind of central point of the show where it becomes more about relationships, it becomes very human. Gillian?
Yeah, effectively, in order to make sense of where we've gotten to, we felt like we needed to offer the context historically. So we bring the audience up to speed of how we got to where we are now. And then we felt it was really important to talk incredibly truthfully about our, well, you might not recognise it as being us, but it certainly was almost verbatim, discussing how helpless one can feel. Because when you start concerning yourself with sexism, you're also concerning yourself with racism, with this law, with gun laws, with privatisation of public assets. It just goes on and on and on. And so we thought it might be useful to express to the audience that actually a lot of us feel overwhelmed by that kind of information. And I understand it happens and I'm frustrated by it, but ultimately I kind of let it happen because I don't know how to insert myself into it and make myself useful short of going off the grid or starting a riot. And we kind of thought that might be a nice place to kick off from what we concern ourselves with being the second half of the show, to say it's okay to feel completely paralysed by this because a number of us do, including me.
It's interesting you use that phrase off-grid, actually, because I know a few people who sort of consciously said, I'm going to go off-grid, I'm going to live or work somewhere else. It's virtually impossible to do, isn't it?
It really is. Absolutely. In fact, Rachel was, we were discussing that just the other day about a gentleman who had attempted to remove, in the show it is unveiled, spoiler alert, that there is a massive government data centre, which is a huge storage facility, effectively, in America, where all information, all digital information is stored and kept on a scale that's completely unfathomable. And even though you may feel like you are deleting something because you get to press the button, it will never disappear. And actually to get ownership over the information you've already given away is virtually impossible.
I wanted to ask you something about theatre and the state of theatre more generally. And there's a number of supporters, I think, who've kind of helped this tour and helped this production. Yeah. So you've got sort of art centres, universities, other kind of funders, National Lottery.
It's the Arts Council.
Arts Council. Those kind of
Arts Council England, yeah.
So I'm just wondering, with something like this, which is potentially, well, it's experimental, let's call it that, it's quite provocative, is it more difficult to fund those kind of things now because of scarcity of funding, or...?
I think generally, the arts in general is kind of being hit horribly, and there's always this case at the moment that the arts is all about the money, and that the money is the primary thing, and it's growth, and it's this and that. And actually, you know, the arts are vital, the arts are important. They give us a platform to talk about these terrible, terrifying things. We felt overwhelmed by... certainly all this information and what we were researching, what we were discovering. And as artists, as theatre makers, we're lucky enough to have a platform, have a space where we've got some people in a room for an hour and we can start a conversation. Even if you tell people the bare facts, the cold hard truth of what's going on, it's kind of dull, it's kind of boring, and it falls out of your mind and you just kind of don't care, and you just, you know, Facebook's easy, it's fun to use, I'll just put it on there. But as humans, we gravitate towards stories and towards narratives and towards kind of something more theatrical, something more artistic. By telling a story, we help to unlock these things and you can actually affect a change. So I think, it's hard to get it's hard to get anything funded and supported. You know, I mean, Mac here has suffered a really horrific cut at the moment. And they're battling against that and want people, you know, people love this venue and Mac are really encouraging them to, if you love us, use us, help this venue to keep going. But it's the same all across the landscape, and it's kind of really sad because now, when the world is in quite such a parlous state, it's more important than ever that we've got ways of expressing ourselves, of coming together.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think actually what is additionally disappointing, it's not just about... a particular form of disseminating information that's being quashed by cutting funding. It's a building for communities to form. It's a space for people to engage with one another socially, with their children, with their neighbours whom they might not otherwise meet. And not to take it too far away from the subject, but it's not just the arts, it's libraries, it's education, all of the platforms by which we might learn and
remember,
exchange, are being seen as less important because financially it's very difficult, we are informed, to equate that to growth because it's slow.
And there's a tension there, isn't there, between the kind of community focus and that kind of culture of individualism that has been in part
driven,
thrust yep. forward by technology, absolutely. Isn't it? In terms of how we live our lives.
I mean, we need the arts now more than ever to bring us together for shared experience, for learning, for understanding, so that as people we grow rather than as an economy growing.
Just to finish, I'm going to ask you a very important wardrobe question. Okay.
No.
Not about wardrobes, but about costumes. Okay. Now there's a very prominent magenta balaclava.
There is
in the performance.
The pink balas.
Pink balaclava.
And the balaclava, has had a checkered history. Shall we say?
Sure.
But do you think the balaclava is now something that is kind of? Do you think it's a kind of weapon of anonymity, or do you think it's now something that symbolises something that makes people more visible?
It's a very difficult question, and as children of the 80s we had this discussion when we made this piece, we were both born in 1980, and had very particular memories of black balaclavas being used for acts of terrorism in the UK, and we started working with black balaclavas and found it incredibly difficult to see it as something other than
what we'd seen on the news as kids.
Basically something that was in relation to acts of violence, and that wasn't our intention. Initially it was about anonymity.
And protest, perhaps, and the right to privacy. And we wanted the right for the balaclava to be able to reference an act of terrorism, but then also reference an act of protest or an act of anonymity. So with it being pink, it just kind of, and obviously it references Pussy Riot as well, and those kind of protest and that kind of activism, the colour, and the pink's just great, it moves us away from that black balaclava and it only being one thing and allows it to be many things.
It's a very underworn garment, I think, now, isn't it?
Do you think?
I think so.
A bit
like the black or brown shirt, I think.
History
has kind of cast it somewhere.
We did recognise the potential for it to be an incredibly threatening garment, and I think that's why we went very pink, because it needed to seem non-threatening but purposeful, and I think Pussy Riot got that very, very right.
It is very pink, and a good place to finish.